So our next speaker again needs no introduction, Margaret Wright, who's over a long period of time done a great job in bridging the gap between linear algebra and optimization, and is going to tell us about it today.
Right, the reason I wanted Beresford and Ian to hurry up is so I could get through my 60 slides, which are really meant for actually, that's what I'm doing. But I wanted to say this is the 8th of 8 talks, whose purpose is stated there. Look back on the history of our field, remember the founders, honor their legacy, and review their accomplishments. And I think we should thank Ilse and Sven for organizing this. I think they've been great. We may revise our opinion. So when I thought about doing this, I thought, well, I'll just review many of the connections between optimization and linear algebra, and it soon became clear to me that was going to be impossible. So I picked two. The first one, which Ian has already mentioned a little bit, is rank one updates in the simplex method for linear programming. And the second topic is one that I actually hope all of you will think about because it's not resolved. The history is still going on now. And I think it's quite fascinating how this is developed. So the first one is more developed, the second one less so. All right, linear programming. I've got some equations. I'm just going to review it very quickly. There's a type of formation called standard form, which isn't really standard, where you're minimizing a linear function, c transpose x, subject to ax equals b, and x non-negative. So there are m linear equality constraints, and you assume the matrix A has rank m. So the rows are linearly independent. The optimality conditions are that a point has to be feasible, and that C, which is the gradient of the objective, is a linear combination of the transpose of A and the multiplier Z star, which has to be non-negative. Okay, those are the Lagrange multipliers for the bound constraints. And there has to be a condition called complementarity, which is the product pairwise between z and x has to be 0 for every j. So these are the Lagrange multipliers, as I mentioned. So that's linear programming in standard form. So you need to know what a basic set is. I assume you all know that, but a basic set is a set of indices where they pick out columns of the matrix A to form a non-singular matrix B, which is also called the basis. And since A has rank M, you can always do this. So there's always a set of basic columns. And the remaining columns in the simplex method are called the non-basic columns. One of the great joys of linear programming is it has this completely different terminology, which we'll discuss in a minute. So, and the subscripts B and N, since they're index sets in 1 through N, pick out subvectors and submatrices. Okay, the optimal solution of a linear program almost always, and we won't talk about the few cases where it doesn't happen, lies at a vertex. A vertex for this problem is a feasible point where there are N linearly independent constraints that are satisfied with equality. Okay, the problem has M linear equality constraints, they have to be satisfied, so in order to be a vertex, n minus m of those constraints, x greater than or equal to 0, have to be active, which means at least n minus m variables have to be 0. Okay, so that's a vertex. And George Janzig, in 1947 or thereabouts, the date isn't completely clear, invented, some people say discovered, as if the simplex method was just lying around and he found it, created the simplex method. And the way the simplex method solves linear programs is it says, I know the solution lies at a vertex, I'm going to start in vertex and I'm going to keep moving from vertex to vertex, there can only be a finite number of them until I find the solution. So how does the simplex method do this? And the mechanisms are the properties of a basic set, which I already mentioned, the fact that the iterates have to satisfy AX equals B, so the search direction that you move along to keep satisfying those has to lie in the null space, and the non-negativity requirement for those multipliers Z. Okay, so here are the steps of the simplex method. I don't particularly want to go through them, except to point out the linear systems that are involved. So the multipliers come from solving B transpose Y equals CB. Those are the basic components of the objective vector. So that's a linear system with B transpose, and then you calculate the multipliers for the non-basic variables. And you know those have to be non-negative at the optimal point, and if they're optimal, you stop. Because those variables are 0, so we have complementarity satisfied. Otherwise, there has to be a negative one. You pick a negative one, and then you calculate a search direction for the basic variables by solving a linear system. BPB, that's the search direction for the basic variables, equals minus column new S of A, where that's the one that was picked out as having the negative multiplier. Then you have to stay feasible. You step along that direction till you get to the next iterate, which happens when another variable is blocking you, and you're going to add that to the index set. So that's going to become non-basic. Okay, so the basic and non-basic index sets get updated. You replace a column of B, and you replace a column of N. Swap columns, actually. So what are the linear algebraic calculations? You have to solve two square systems. They're the transpose of each other. And if the point that you're at is not optimal, you have to replace a column of B and put that into N. So this is what you do in the simplex method. And column replacement, of course, is a special rank one modification. Now, Ian mentioned when you're programming in the context of a sparse direct solve, calculating the LU factorization. But that's not what makes the simplex method, which, by the way, also appeared on the top 10 algorithms of the 20th century list, in this famous list. That's not what makes the simplex method effective. So I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but Ian already gave some of these dates. So 47, Danzig invented the simplex method. In 47, there was a project called SCOOP, Scientific Computation of Optimal Programs. During World War II and shortly thereafter, program meant a schedule or arrangement. It did not refer to a computer program. This was a U.S. Air Force group. Alex Ordman in 52 invented, we're going to say, the product form of the inverse. He's quoted as saying the simplex procedure may be considered as a generalization of elimination. Orchard Hayes, Ian mentioned him, programmed the simplex method for an IBM CPC, card program calculator. Diane mentioned this in her talk. And Markovitz, we've already heard, developed the elimination form of the inverse for sparse matrices. Okay, so I've gotten a lot of this material from two great articles by Saul Gass, what's called the first linear programming shop, spelled in a cutesy way on purpose, and then Saul Gass and Assad wrote a timeline of OR. So in the spirit somewhat of what Diane was saying, I think when we think about pioneering people in history since computers have been invented, we have to try to go back and think of the kind of computational machines they had. So they had decks of punch cards. Some of us actually remember decks of punch cards. They were run on card program calculators, which were formed by connecting IBM office equipment. So this is a pretty vivid thing that's described in Sal Gass's book. So in 1950, when they were doing linear programming, they had 80 mechanical counters in the accounting machine, which was an IBM tabulator. There was storage for a whopping 16 10-digit numbers, so not too many numbers, which were relayed from an electronic calculator. And it could perform 2,000 additions or subtractions per second, or 86 multiplication or divisions per second. A Gauss-Seidel inversion of a 10x10 matrix took 30 minutes to 70 decimal places. I think this should all make us realize how unbelievably spoiled we are and how lucky maybe graduate students are that don't have to run these machines. Anyway, so this was the environment. Okay, and this is my favorite quote. I'm just going to read part of it. In the revised simplex method, both the inverse and the inverse transpose are needed. So remember those two linear systems where one is B, one is B transpose. However, more significant is the fact that each iteration replaces one of the columns of the basis. So Ian didn't mention this. It's not that you're refactorizing B every time. You're updating it. Thus, only one additional column of information is recorded using the IBM card program calculator and novel feature results. When the inverse matrix is needed at one stage and the transpose at another, it is achieved simply by turning over the deck of cards. Okay, so this is about the product form of the inverse and the simplex method. So I bet they were so happy when they got to do that. In any case, Ordman proposed the so-called product form of the inverse and Gauss-Jordan inversion. He said he noticed that you didn't have to refactorize, reinvert the matrix every time. Leaving it in product form cut the amount of computation in half. So he says when he joined SCOOP, the simplex method was waiting for the same trick. And Markowitz's elimination form of the inverse, which Ian already mentioned. So you solve maybe the original, keep going to point, P is BP is B is expressed as P equals B inverse B, and you just do elimination. So you've eliminated everything, and then when you do the column replacement, you just have to multiply by one more elementary matrix. So this is what makes the simplex method efficient. This is what makes it fast. If it were just using LU at every step, it would never work. Okay, but now I haven't mentioned really linear algebra, except I've talked about solving systems. As far as I can tell, the simplex people went ahead, they lived in their own world, they had tableaus and they had all these things, but they never really thought about numerical stability. In 1969, Bartels and Golub said, you should not have the product form of the inverse. You should not have these elimination matrices that you're just multiplying by without taking any account of pivoting or stability. So they proposed updating the LU factors and stabilized product form. Now, I could go on and on about how this misleading terminology is really confusing, but in fact, they don't actually update L and they don't update U explicitly. They update L with stabilized elementary transformations, and they keep U and update U explicitly. And they kind of check the conditioning by assuming L is a unit lower triangular matrix, so it's well conditioned, and they monitor the condition by checking U. I see Michael Saunders looking at me, he'll correct me if I make too many egregious mistakes. In 72, Forrest and Tomlin proposed fast updates of LU and LP for sparse matrices. This connects to Ian's story now. Turned out most of the LPs that were beginning to be solved were getting larger and larger, they had bigger computers, and they had sparse matrices. And Forrest and Tomlin proposed this update. It's a restricted form of Bartels-Golub with a lot less attention to stability. And even today, it's by far the most popular choice in implementations of the simplex method, which causes some numerical analysts to tear out their hair. John Reed, the same Reed that Ian mentioned, in 82, came up with a sparse and efficient implementation of Bartels-Golub. And in 84, Fletcher and Matthews, on the other side of the Atlantic, as Ian was saying, came up with a way to do updates of L and U and complete. Okay, so these are sort of some of the early things that linear algebra did. Now, unfortunately, and this is a great sorrow, you can't, at least I don't know how, to explain these updates simply when you have interchanges. You start drawing pictures, you have column spikes, upper triangles, upper Hessenberg forms, or you have column spikes and upper triangles and row spikes, and you have sweeps, and it's very confusing. And this may be one reason that people that work in this field often say, I don't want to hear about stability. I don't want to hear about interchanges. Just take care of it for me. But it does get done, and we all have to be grateful to the people like John Reed and Michael Saunders and others who've written sparse LU codes that actually do these updates stably. In practice, you update the LU for a while, and then every so often you refactorize and you monitor the growth in the elements of the updated upper triangle, as I said, and then you refactorize. So research is still going on in this area, because today in active set methods, you don't necessarily have a square basis, you don't necessarily have precisely n constraints active, you have rectangular matrices. So active set methods use very similar ideas. I do not have time to talk about that. But this is an area where for LP, the generation of numerical people made a huge contribution, and it's partly because of the rank one updates, and it's partly because of doing sparsity, and it's partly because of paying a lot of attention to stability. And this is still going on today. Okay, my second topic, since I told Beresford I was keeping an eye on his time, I have to keep an eye on my own time. This is the one that I feel shows the interaction between linear algebra and optimization, and it's one that I do not consider a solved problem. I've called it convexification in Newton-based methods. That's not a great word, but let me explain what I mean. So we all know Newton's method, and I'm not going to go back to Newton. Okay? We're just going to say it, because I've heard big arguments, this isn't really Newton's method. somebody else, it was Raf's and whatever. So we're going to minimize a twice differentiable function. We're going to use Newton's method and the pure Newton step. P is defined at the point x as satisfying the linear system Hessian times P equals minus greater. If that's the pure Newton step, remember it's twice continuously differentiable, we're not going to worry about strangeness as a derivative. Now, there are different interpretations of Newton's method. Some people object violently to what I'm about to say, but they're not in this room. So, if the matrix H, the Hessian, is positive definite, you can interpret the pure Newton step as a step to the unique minimizer of a local strictly convex quadratic model. So you have this function, you interpret it as locally by an approximation that's a strictly convex quadratic model, and this gives you the step to the minimizer of that quadratic model. And this is famous for its local quadratic convergence and for various other properties as well. So we all know about Newton's method. But I want to just emphasize the point that if you believe what I said, which you may not, there's this quadratic model, and the reason you're choosing this step is it's the step to the minimizer of that model. Okay, so in my abstract, I mentioned two things. I mentioned Dancy and I mentioned Courant. It's not just that I work at the Courant Institute. Courant made this really amazing address to the American Mathematical Society in 1943, in which some people say he introduced the idea of finite element methods. He introduced the idea of the quadratic penalty function, and he talked about Newton's method. Okay? It's called Variational Methods for the Solution of Problems of Equilibrium and Vibrations, and he also talks about the goals of applied mathematics and how we should be thinking about real problems. It's truly a remarkable paper. Anyway, he says the M parameter CI, these are the Newton step, which we may now determine from the ordinary minimum problem of the calculus, which leads to a system of linear equations for the parameters, a system which may be solved by established methods. So he doesn't really get into it very much, except to say this is how we get Newton's method. He just says we're going to solve it by established methods. And he doesn't make any mention of special properties of the matrix. It's just sort of an offhand comment. But I wanted to include it because I think it's such a great paper. Okay, so what about Newton's method? Well, if you hunt around for early papers about Newton's method that mention sort of properties of it in terms of matrices, there aren't very many. There's Crockett and Chernoff, 55, in the Pacific Journal of Mathematics, Gradient Methods for Maximization, and a Sion Review paper in 62 by Spang, a review of minimization techniques for nonlinear functions. Chernoff is still alive and at Harvard. I don't know about these other people. Okay, Chernoff is really mainly known as a statistician. So both of these papers talk about Newton's method and they show quadratic convergence and they do this and that. And they make kind of an offhand comment about, oh, by the way, if you're minimizing the method, we're assuming the matrix is positive definite. Okay, they just kind of, I mean, the Crockett and Chernoff assumes it's maximizing, but it's the same idea. But Newton's method was clearly around in the mid to late 1950s. There's a famous textbook by Hildebrand about numerical analysis. It discusses Newton's method. So it's sort of as if people use Newton's method, but they just sort of assumed, I guess, that the matrix was going to have the right structure. But what if it doesn't? Okay, really, as far as I could tell, and I didn't do a totally detailed search about this, people didn't think about what happens when your matrix is not positive definite. And so what do you do if you're using Newton's method, you want to use it, and you have a quadratic model that isn't actually convex? And this is why I said you should think about this, because we'll talk about this in a second. So in linear algebraic terms, what do we do if there's a Hessian or Hessian-like matrix that isn't positive definite? I say, or more generally, does not have the correct inertia, because in methods for constrained optimization, like primal dual methods, interior methods, etc., today, sometimes you're talking about KKT matrices. And the whole matrix doesn't have to be positive definite, but a certain part of it has to have a certain number of positive eigenvalues. Okay, so it has to have the correct inertia. So this was sort of going on. People were saying, I'm going to solve these equations for the Newton step. But when did optimizers who were actually thinking about linear algebra start to think about this picture? The earliest one I can find is a paper by John Greenstead in 67 on the relative efficiencies of gradient methods. It was a math of pump. Here's what he proposed. He said, take the Hessian, calculate its eigendecomposition. Remember, it's symmetric, so you can do that. He said, if there are any negative eigenvalues, make them positive. And if there are any eigenvalues that are too small, make them some small number, but not too small. So there's an interesting interpretation of this. It's one of the few of these where there's a clear interpretation. It's saying, here's this quadratic model. Some of the directions are going uphill, some of the directions are going downhill. The eigenvectors allow us to pick out the ones that are going both ways. The ones that are going uphill go the other way and go the same distance along that direction that you would have done if you were going the right way. And then it fixes up the small one. So there's a clear geometric interpretation of what Greenstead means. In 74, Gill and Murray, Gill is in the room, wrote a paper called Newton-type methods for unconstrained and linearly constrained optimization. They proposed what they call the modified Cholesky factorization. So in this, you replace this matrix H by H plus E, where E is diagonal, but it's not a multiple of the identity in general. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. So E is a diagonal matrix, and if H is sufficiently positive definite, E will just be zero. So you'll just get the Newton direction that you would have gotten. And if it's not sufficiently positive definite, you add something along the diagonal. Okay, so this was a very clever idea that's still used a lot today. In 79, Morey and Sorensen may be in the room, I don't know, wrote a paper called On the Use of Directions in Negative Curvature in a Modified Newton Method Mathematical Programming. One of their big points was how inadequate the modified Cholesky factorization of Gill and Murray was in producing certain kinds of results in optimization. And so they proposed a technique based on symmetric indefinite factorization, which had become popular by then, right? Bunch Parlett, Bunch Kaufman, etc. So they used the symmetric indefinite factorization to get so-called directions of negative curvature, which means if you're at a stationary point of a quadratic function that the Hessian's not definite, you can actually move along and go downhill. When we wrote our book, Practical Optimization, we presented modified Cholesky with symmetric interchanges. In 1990, Schnabel and Esko presented a new modified Cholesky factorization. They had found that the Gill and Murray technique added too much to the Hessian. And they proposed a new method. It was still based on Cholesky, but it used Gershkorn disks to try to get better estimates of how much to add to the Hessian. So I just want to make a comment about what's going on here as contrasted to the Greenstead thing. So in these methods, you're taking a matrix, you're doing something, like you're starting to run Cholesky, and it tells you if the matrix is positive definite. So the first thing you have to be able to do is efficiently decide whether the matrix is positive definite or not. And you want that to come out and not to cost too much. That's why the Cholesky and the symmetric indefinite factorization are useful as compared to the eigenvalue one. But you don't want to add more than you, quote, have to. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean you should try to find the nearest positive definite matrix? Probably not, because that would have little teeny eigenvalues. It would be close, but it wouldn't be very good. So you have to find a matrix which is close to the, so it produces one that's close to the original matrix, it's positive definite, but you're not adding too much and you're doing this in an efficient way. And I think Schnabel and Esko laid down these rules about what they intended to do. I've thrown in the interior point revolution in 1984 because what started happening then, and it's another example of how optimization and linear algebra interacted, suddenly people started thinking about different kinds of matrices, in particular the ones that came from barrier functions, the one that came from primal dual methods, which suddenly now had matrices with blocks of zeros or blocks of things where the elements went from zero or teeny to huge. They were very badly conditioned, but they had a lot of structure. So this contributed to linear algebra as well. Forsgren, Gill, and Murray talked about computing modified Newton directions using a partial Cholesky factorization in 1995. This is based on the symmetric indefinite factorization. Chang and Higham, I think Higham is here, wrote this paper, a modified Cholesky algorithm based on a symmetric indefinite factorization, where they tried to do something cleverer than what had been done before, based on these principles that I've articulated in a vague way of trying to add something to make it positive definite, but not adding too much, and sort of doing the right thing. In 99, Schnabel and Esko published a paper, a revised, modified Cholesky factorization. This was because it turned out that their original method, which most people thought was much better than the Gill-Murray one, didn't do well on certain matrices that came from interior methods. It added way too much to the diagonal. It would add huge numbers to the diagonal when it really didn't have to. So they modified it. And then I want you all to read Fang and O'Leary. This is O'Leary. Modified Cholesky algorithms and cataloging new approaches. This appeared in math programming. I don't know how you did this. They basically went through all the modified Cholesky routines. They proved all the properties of them. They have tables. They have principles. They have new approaches. It's a great paper. And it summarizes this whole thing. And there are many papers in optimization about regularization. Now, this is one where you add multiples of the identity. The original modified Cholesky did not add a multiple of the identity, did not shift all the eigenvalues. It just added bits on the diagonal. So it's important to keep that in mind, that that's different. So there are regularization techniques at Fargo-Dewell, the regularization techniques at SQP, the regularization techniques at all kinds of optimization methods. And these have the same purpose. They're trying to take something that may be indefinite, make it positive definite. They're trying to take a problem that may be non-convex and make it convex. Okay, so now I still have a few minutes, talk about how we want to make a non-positive definite matrix positive definite. And as I said, this way includes way to determine a reasonable cost, whether it is positive definite or not, and if it's sufficiently positive definite. And the big stumbling block, which I want to emphasize over and over, is it's not clear what the ideal solution would be. So if expense were no object, what would you really like to get? You're doing Newton's method, you have an indefinite Hessian, what would you like to get? Newton's method, in which the Hessian is always positive definite, doesn't always perform very well. It can be ill-conditioned, it can give you very bad steps. You can cook up examples where steepest descent does better than Newton's method. So having just it to be positive definite is not necessarily solving all the problem. If it's positive definite, the pure Newton direction is a descent direction, but it may not be a good direction. So one is sort of a linear algebra issue, one is an optimization issue. And on the bright side, this problem is not well defined. So you can write papers about it, and you can hand wave, and you can say, I have a new regularization technique, blah, 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 blah. And you don't have to really prove anything, because it's not like you have a goal of what we're trying to get. So I'm now going to do a kind of a smart-alecky thing. Sorry. We all know that if Cholesky is stable, if the matrix is positive definite enough, but if it isn't, we don't have an LDLT that behaves well. So we have the famous 2x2 example, 0110, where there's no LDLT, and we know that even if LDLT exists, there's no a priori bound on the elements of L and D. So we've all taught linear algebra, I think. We all show our students this example, epsilon 1, 1, epsilon. And the 2-1 element of L is 1 over epsilon, and the diagonals of D are epsilon, and epsilon minus 1 over epsilon. So what does this show? It shows that when you play around with factorizations of indefinite matrices, once you switch away from positive definite, things can be very tricky. Now, here's the smart algebra. Doesn't everybody know this? Isn't there a path between linear algebra and optimization? Apparently not. So there's a very popular software package for nonlinearly constrained optimization, where the authors have published this algorithm for what they do about an indefinite Hessian. Okay, they replace an indefinite Hessian by H plus delta I. So they add a multiple of the identity. First step, compute the LDLT of H. This should send off big warning bells in your head. Because then they say, scan the diagonal elements, look for any that have the wrong sign, take the largest in magnitude, multiply it, and choose that as done. Well, Bianca McCormick actually made a similarly bad suggestion in their book, but I don't think anybody paid a lot of attention to it. Anyway, this is in a software package. And you can see this, and we've talked a lot about sparse matrices with millions of rows and things. This is a 2x2 example, two variables. It's kind of weird, but it shows a point. So you minimize x1, x2, and then you have those two inequality constraints, which are, of course, not the x1 cubed between 0 and 2, and the x2 cubed between minus 1 and 3. So that's the solution, cube root of 2 and minus 1. And if you start at this point, 10 to the minus 7 minus 10 to the minus 7, with multiplier set equal to 1, the Hessian of the Lagrangian is 1.2 times 10 to the minus 4, 1, 1, 6 times 10 to the minus 5. That looks a lot like that bad 2x2 matrix. So just for fun, I thought a week ago, let's run this problem. Argonne has this great thing called MEOS, where you can submit optimization problems and run them for you and give you the answer. So this is where all my slides come in. So this is a verbatim extract from the latest version of this software, which I will not name, on MEOS. So we start at that point, non-convex subproblem, right? Diag 5 is 1.5. I don't know where they got that. I think it's some matrix. They add a perturbation of 1.65. So you can see that they're multiplying this by 1.1. Then what happens is what I said. They've made a positive definite matrix, but it takes a terrible step. Okay, it doesn't have to really do much to get away from that bad point. In fact, if you use SNOP, which does not use second derivatives, it has no trouble with this problem. The next step, you have a bigger perturbation. Now it's 44, then it goes to 800, then it goes to 1.6 times 10 to the fourth, then it goes to 3.2 times 10 to the fifth, and it keeps on going up to 10 to the 10th. And it's actually not going anywhere, it's just moving closer and closer to a really bad point, and this thing that I showed you with the LDLT is coming in, so it's adding a perturbation of 10 to the 10th. And it goes on for 23 more iterations, barely moving at all, adding perturbations of 10 to the 10th, and then it kind of rallies. You see the perturbations start getting small, goes down, it does 42 more iterations, and it finds the optimal solution. But the problem is in the linear algebra. The problem is it's doing this really bad thing for dealing with the indefinite case. Okay, so they're very complicated strategies. No single strategy is guaranteed every time. Now, I will name a code. There's a code called IPOPT. It's one of the best interior point codes today. And even IPOPT has a little bit of a problem with this. It's a slightly different kind of problem. And they're showing up through the linear algebra. So here we now are running IPOPT. And notice what it says. It's doing, I think it's MA27, yes, MA27 T-solver interface, negative 5 prime equals 5, but there are only 4. It fails. It does another one. It too is adding a diagonal of perturbation of the identity. It fails, it fails. It took 5 factorizations. Okay? And so this, I looked up what algorithm IPOP uses, and it says it's a heuristic iterative procedure for choosing this perturbation. So I think I may write to the authors about this heuristic perturbation. It goes on for 24 iterations. This is a two-variable problem. And the last one where it fails is at iteration 24. It does 2 factorizations, and after that it's fine, and it gets in. Okay. So, what am I saying? We have not solved this problem. We have not found, in my opinion, a perfect solution, particularly for constrained problems with the KKT matrix. Diane and Fang did a great job of summarizing what happens in unconstrained problems. It may be that those techniques could be used for KKT systems, I don't know. But we have to generate linear systems for these non-convex situations that actually work well in optimization problems. In my opinion, it's ridiculous that a problem this simple, where you don't have to do much, having the Hessian makes it worse than if you didn't have the Hessian at all. I think that's a pretty sad commentary on what we're doing. So this is an appeal. This is an area that's been studied for a while. We need to figure out what these modifications mean and how to make it work well. Last slide. I think we should salute the pioneer people in linear algebra and optimization who have done all these great things and produced a lively research area, linear algebra and optimization, together forever.
Margaret. Ilse and I really are so grateful to all 8 speakers in these 2 sessions. They've all taken the task really seriously. I know it's been a lot of hard work for them, so please let's thank all 8 speakers. And the audience has been terrific, all staying here till 10 o'clock at night.